Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Tom Lounges. This is Midwest Beat. Thank you for listening here on Lakeshore Public Radio and online if you're streaming us at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This is a sad show for me. A gentleman that has been on this program and my previous programs with other stations, and, well, Charlie Daniels. I'm sure by now you've heard that he passed away. He was age 83. He passed from a hemorrhagic stroke. And actually, as we're speaking right now, there is a memorial and funeral procession going on in Nashville, Tennessee, Mount Juliet, Tennessee, actually, where he is from. And today we are going to remember Charlie by letting him do the talking in many instances. I've culled some different choice nuggets, favorites of mine, from different interviews over the years. Again, my first interview with Charlie was 40 years ago. Million Mile Reflections was the album he was promoting. A little song called Devil Went Down to Georgia was his newest single. And at the end of this show, the last hour of this show, in fact, most of that hour will be filled with my final interview with Charlie, which took place just a few months back as he was celebrating the 40th anniversary of Devil Went Down to Georgia at the end of 2019. Right before all this madness called COVID hit. So I'm pleased that I was able to interview Charlie so many times, meet him many times, hang out with him on the tour bus, get to MC shows for him. And as I put in my column in the Times, if you read it, he was kind of like a favorite uncle of mine. I mean, we weren't close. We weren't bosom buddies. But he was someone that interacted with my life so many times over the last four decades that he became almost like a distant relative. And getting a phone call from Charlie, which became an annual or biannual tradition in most cases, was always a welcome. You know, you get that favorite uncle that sometimes pops in by surprise, but it's always a welcome surprise. Well, that was what it was like to talk to Charlie. And, of course, we always did our professional journalism and all that thing that we had to do in the beginning. And then we'd wind up talking and socializing about how was the family, what are you doing, you know, how's the kids, that kind of thing. And he was just one of those guys that no matter how famous, no matter how many hits, he was just the guy next door kind of guy, a blue-collar guy, a Christian man, and always cared about everyone he talked to. I'm going to read some clips in a little bit from some of his contemporaries that came out in the wake of his death, and I know there's a few folks I know that had personal encounters with Charlie, and not once have I heard a negative word. But we're going to get to that in just a bit. Right now, let's refresh your memory with a one-minute clip of some of his biggest hits. See how many of these you can remember. I'm sure you'll be recognizing these songs. I'll be right back at you.
Johnny, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard.
These colors don't run and we speak as one.
All right, how many of those did you recognize? Those were just a toe in the water, so to speak. A toe in the old creek, the pond, as Charlie might say, of his wonderful career in music. So many songs that he sent to us. And basically, his music is going to live on forever. And one of the things I liked about Charlie is, yeah, he was a co-founder and a pioneer of Southern rock, but he did so many other things. He did gospel. He did bluegrass. He did hard rock. He did blues. I mean, he did everything. He kind of took it all the music he was raised in on the radio, and he spun it into the unique sound that was Charlie Daniels. And what made him different from Southern rock, and this is something we will discuss during some of the clips of our interviews, is the fact that he put the fiddle into Southern rock. Everybody else did the three-guitar army, the Skinnards, the Outlaws, the Molly Hatchets. Charlie had a lot of guitar, and he was a great guitar player, but he flavored it, if you will, with so much good fiddle music, and that made him stand out. Let's read a couple of quick clips, and then we'll get into some clips of my own. Charlie Daniels was someone you could lean on at any time or ask his advice. I'm so blessed and pleased to have known him as a peer, a friend, and a performer, and had the opportunity of performing many times with him. The Devil Went Down to Georgia. Well, the devil never had a chance. And now Charlie is playing with that fiddle, is playing his fiddle in that Heavenly Angels big band above. Someday I'll see you again, Charlie. That was from Tanya Tucker, who herself is on a resurgence these days. Here's another one from the Bellamy Brothers. We are very sad today as the news of Charlie Daniels passing. He was a great entertainer, a great friend, and a great American. And let's do one more. Let's see if we can pull another one here. How about Doug Gray? Marshall Tucker Band and Charlie Daniels Band had many interactions together. In fact, Charlie played fiddle on almost all the Marshall Tucker albums. And we'll touch on that a little later, too. I think I've got a clip about that. Here's what Doug Gray, lead singer and founder of Marshall Tucker, had to say. It's a sad day for a Southern gentleman, a soft-spoken, godly man, a man I have known for 50 years. Yes, my heart is broken, but Hazel and Charlie Jr. have all of us holding them with the strength that Mr. Daniels has given us throughout the years. We are missing a man that already has the hands of his great God holding him. I have no words. That's Doug Gray from the Marshall Tucker Band. Again, the accolades and the memories have poured forth from all the Nashville stars, all the rock stars, all the celebrities that knew Charlie. And you can go on Facebook and just pull up memory after memory. But let's get into some memories. As I mentioned, I met Charlie 40 years ago. Our first interview took place at the Uptown Theater in Chicago on the Million Mile Reflections Tour. We'll get to some of his songs in this, but a lot of what you're going to hear is pre-recorded interviews from me and Charlie over the years. One of the things that got Charlie's career started, and of course we're going to talk about his years with Bob Dylan and all the other things he did, but how many of you realize that Elvis Presley really got the foot in the door for Charlie Daniels? Well, it's true. Charlie remembers that on this clip because this is what I call Elvis Does Charlie. It's a song that Charlie wrote that Elvis sang called It Hurts Me. And we're going to hear that song after we talk to Charlie. Let's take it away with this clip.
Well, a full decade before you actually charted under your own name as a performer, you hit the charts as a songwriter when Elvis Presley recorded It Hurts Me. As a Southerner, as a guy who started out about the same time, what was it like? It had to be some kind of milestone for you when you first heard Elvis sing your song on the radio.
It was absolutely euphoric. There's no other way to describe it. Elvis Presley was by far the biggest artist in the world at that time. And it was back in the days, the old 45s, when the radio stations actually got records and played both sides of them, especially an Elvis Presley cut. We were on the flip side of a song called Kissing Cousins, out of a movie called Kissing Cousins, and our song was not in the movie, but we were on the flip side of it. So they played Kissing Cousins for a while, and then they flipped it over and played It Hurts Me. It was just, you know, it was unbelievable. It was like a dream. It was by far the biggest thing that happened to me in the music business at that time, and every time I would hear it, it would just put me on cloud nine.
I can imagine. Did you ever get a chance to meet Elvis or record with him?
I never did. I never, you know, I probably could have facilitated that back in the 70s, but I let the time slip away, and I didn't try to, and so, no, I never got to meet him. I wish I could have.
It hurts me to see him treat you the way that he does. It hurts me to see you sit and cry when I know I could be so true if I had someone like you. It hurts me to see those tears in your eyes. And when I know I could be so true if I had someone like you, it hurts me to see the way he makes you cry. You love him so much, you're too blind to see his own. He's
he's just that kind of guy. But if you ever tell him you're through, I'll be waiting for you, waiting to hold you so tight, waiting to kiss you goodnight. Yes, darling, if I had someone like you.
It hurts me, but it helped him. It helped Charlie Daniels. Back in the 1960s, that was a song that Charlie wrote, and Elvis liked it and recorded it. As he said, it was the flip side of Kissin' Cousins. And DJs back in the day, if it was an Elvis record, man, they couldn't get enough of the King, and they would flip that record over back and forth and play everything he recorded, and that's why that song got a big break for Charlie Daniels. Again, today we are honoring Charlie Daniels, who passed away at the age of 83 a few days back. And today, right now, as we speak, there is services going on. There was a memorial service, a public service held today, and I really wish I could have been there. I had planned to go until I found out just last night when it was in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And Travis Tritt, Vince Gill, Gretchen Wilson, Trace Atkins, and a few others were performing at this service to celebrate the life and music of Charlie. He will be entered into a private burial at Mount Juliet Memorial Gardens in his home of Mount Juliet, Tennessee, later today. So you can make contributions, as I will, to the Journey Home Project, which was Charlie's project to benefit the U.S. military that are returning home and need a help with education or health or family or pretty much anything. It was his memorial that will live on to the soldiers that he loved so much. So let's move on now. We heard his connection to Elvis and the biggest break he got in his career, which really put him in the fast lane, got him on the radar, was getting a credit on some Bob Dylan records. In fact, Charlie told me, and I don't remember if it's in this clip, so I'll tell you real quick. Charlie got a call, and the guitar player who was scheduled for the Bob Dylan Nashville sessions for some reason couldn't make the first session. So his friend, who was producing the session, called him and said, hey, you know, I need you to fill in. So Charlie went down, he filled in, he was packing his guitar to leave after that session, and Bob Dylan said, oh no, you ain't going anywhere. I like you and I like your style. So he stayed on and recorded several albums with Bob. And this is the story. I open up with me asking him about it, and then Charlie will talk. We'll hear some songs as well. So stay with us on Lakeshore.
They had booked 15 recording sessions to complete the work on Nashville Skyline album that Bob did. And a real-time Nashville session player was supposed to play on all 15 sessions, but he was booked on the very first one and couldn't make it. So I was asked to go in and fill in for him. And so I just really concentrated and tried to do the very best I could interpreting Bob's music. And when we got finished the first session, he didn't want me to leave. He wanted me to stay around. So we wanted to do that album and then a couple other albums, Nashville Skyline, Self-Portrait, New Morning. And I was a big Bob Dylan fan before then. You might imagine what I turned into after that.
Now, your latest album, Off the Grid, Doing It Dylan, is an homage, if you will, of that era of your career. And that is the album that's got you on tour right now. So let's play something, and then we'll go back into the past a little more. But what would you like to play off the Dylan album that you feel is really represents it?
Well, you know, a song we do every night that I film stage that I think really does represent it is Tangled Up in Blue.
All right, that's a classic track and one of my favorites as well. So here we go on 89.1 FM Lakeshore Midwest Beat. This is Tangled Up in Blue, the CDB.
Early one morning, the sun was shining. I was a lady in bed, wondering if she had changed it all and if her hair was still red. Her folks said that our lives together, she was gonna be rough. They never did like Mama's homemade dress, Papa's bank wasn't enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Well, you know I paid some dues getting through. Tangled up in blue. She was married when we first met, soon to be divorced. I helped her out of a jam, I guess, but I used a little too much force. We
drove back car as far as we could, abandoned it out west. Spit up on the dark set night, but for being that it was best. She turned around to look at me as I was walking away. I heard her say over my shoulder, we'll meet again someday on the avenue. Tangled up in blue. The great north woods working as a cook for a spell, but I never did like it all that much, and one day the axe just fell. So I drifted on down to New Orleans, where I happened to be employed, working for a while on a fishing boat right outside of Delacroix. But all the while I was all alone, the past was close behind. I seen a lot of women, but you never escaped my mind, and I just grew tangled up in blue. Working at the top of this bar, and I stopped in for a beer. I just kept looking at the side of her face and the spotlight so clear. And later on, as the crowd thinned out, I was just about to do the same. She was standing there in back of my chair, said, "Don't I know your name?" I muttered something under my breath. She studied the lines of my face. I must admit, I felt a little uneasy when she bent down to tie the laces of my shoes. Tangled up in blue.
Charlie Daniels and the CDB, that's off the grid, doing it, Dylan, Tangled Up in Blue. This is Midwest Beat. You're tangled up with me, Tom Lounges, and the man himself, Charlie Daniels, on the phone with us. And let's go back to the very first album, 1970. You went from being a sideman to being a band leader once again, landed a deal with Capitol Records, and the CDB was born. How did all that come about? How did that record deal come?
Tom, it came about, I was doing some record production. I was producing a guy named Jerry Corbett for Capitol Records. And we were in Los Angeles and went in to play some of the stuff we'd been working on for the brass there, whoever, the A&R department. And Jerry's manager, Donald Rubin, was there. And he said, "Charlie, why don't you play some of your songs for the people here?" And there was a guitar there. And I sat down and played a few of my songs. They signed me on the spot. They gave me a record deal right there.
Wow.
And so, I mean, it was, of course, this is back in the day when, you know, record companies were signing a lot of people, and they wanted you to do albums. Of course, nowadays, there's usually that thing where they develop singles, or you do a series of singles before you do an album. Then it was albums. So they wanted me to go do an album, which I did, which was not a hit record, but it got me started in the albums. So we went from there to Kama Sutra Records, and then we had some success there and then moved on in 1976 to Epic Records, where we stayed for 16 years.
Well, many rock critics and rock historians point to that first album. As you mentioned, it wasn't a big seller, but they point to that as being one of the cornerstones, one of the templates, if you will, of what would later become the Southern rock sound. With that album, there was no dividing lines between what was country, what was rock, what was blues. It was like you threw it all into a mix master and it came out all at once. It was a pretty wild album looking back at the time.
Well, you know, we have never actually called our music one particular genre. People ask me, what do you play, country, rock, jazz, what? I say all of it, you know, because we do. I play American music. Some of all the music that America has become known for around the world, the rock music, the country music, bluegrass, gospel, jazz, we play some of all of it. When I came up, I'll be 78 in October, so I go way back, when radio stations where there's not as many as there is now, for one thing, and they were not formatted to one kind of music. They were formatted for news, and some of them had network soap opera zone. They had a lot of music, different kinds of music, but they played some of all of it. And so I got such a wide, you listen to radio in a day's time, you'd hear country music, you'd hear whatever the pop music of the day was, you'd hear gospel on Sunday, you'd hear, if you're from the Southeast, you always get the blues. So I was exposed to so many different kinds of music as a young, impressionable age, that I guess when I got ready to doing original music, it all just kind of mixed together in my head. We just do some of all of it. Sometimes within the confines of one song, we may go through a couple of three different what some people consider genres of music.
Well, let's go back to 1970. That first album that introduced us to Charlie Daniels and the CDB. This is Trudy on Capitol Records.
Call up Trudy on the telephone. Send a letter in the mail. Tell I'm hung up in Dallas. They won't let me out of this jail. John Lee Walker was a car mechanic. Had a hand for trouble and an eye for cash. Luckiest man in Dallas County. He had a gold watch chain and a black mustache. And he loved his whiskey and he loved his women. Drove a big long Cadillac limousine. Kept a big fine fancy townhouse in Dallas. And a hotel suite in New Orleans. Carried a switchblade knife in his left hip pocket. And a 44 hog leg up under his coat. Cut you down in a New York minute. If they catch you cheating, that was all she wrote. So call up Trudy on the telephone. Send her a letter in the mail. Up in Dallas, they won't let me out of this jail. If she asks you how I'm faring, then I'm just about to lose my mind. Worried about old Johnny Lee Walker and the girl I left behind. I just got to town last Friday evening. Sure as hell didn't mean to stay. I was on my way back to Louisiana. Had a powerful thirst and 6 months' pay. I met a peroxide blonde in a bar on D-Bell. I was flying high and feeling mean. Poured down a bottle and a half of red eye. I dropped $35 in the slot machine. And the boys in the back was a dealing seven card. Sit down and won me 110. I was raking in chips like Grant took Richmond. The big John Lee called me strolling in. He red dogged the table like a 707. Pretty soon he done won all of my bread. I accused him of cheating. He reached for a pistol. Side of his head, and then I took off running like a motorcycle. A boot, boot. Heard the bullets whining and the sirens wail. But it took half the cops in Dallas County just to put one cool ass boy in jail.
club in Dallas. And they won't let me out of this jail. If you ask me how I'm feeling, yeah, I'm just about to lose my mind. Worried about old Johnny Walker and the girl I left behind. Call up Judy on the telephone. Send her a letter in the mail. Well, I'm hung up in Dallas. They won't let me out of jail. If you ask me how I'm feeling, well, I'm just about to lose my mind.
Digging back to 1970, a song called Trudy from Charlie Daniels' self-titled debut album for Capitol. This is Midwest Beat. I'm Tom Lounges, my guest, the one and only Charlie Daniels. Charlie, as mentioned, that first album was pretty wild and unpredictable. It was your first for Capitol. The second record, T. John Grease and Wolfmen, was on Kama Sutra, as you mentioned. A couple of albums came out on that label. What happened with Capitol? Why was that a one-off situation?
The first record was just not successful. We didn't have enough material that was, was radio type stuff on there. So it was not, it was not as successful at the time that we did it. So we just made an agreement to move on and went on to Kama Sutra. It's one of the things that it makes no difference how big a record company is or how small it is, basically, for philosophically speaking. You've got to have somebody there who believes in you. And if you're in a place where they don't believe in you, where you have not excited people to one degree or another, you really don't need to be there. You need to move on. So that's what we did. We moved on to find some place where we could get some excitement. And we had success with Kama Sutra Records.
Mm-hmm. Well, Honey in the Rock came up next, and that landed you on the charts for the first time with the Uneasy Rider. And that song, of course, a staple. I'm sure you're doing that in the show, correct?
We do once in a while. We sure do. We get requests for that song, Tom, from people that weren't even born when it came out.
It's classic. It was such a novelty type song. Did it surprise you when it first came out and it was all over the radio?
It did. Well, it surprised me to the extent. I mean, this was like top 10 single. And it did kind of at the time that it took off. It was the first thing that we had that. We're able to watch spread across radio the way that it did, that it just started in small stations and just kept going and going until it finally hit them all across the board. It was a fascinating thing to watch it grow, but yeah, it did. It was an exciting time for me.
Well, the third album, 74's Way Down Yonder, was A Calm Before the Storm. It didn't really catch fire, went by with little notice, but that very same year you gave us Fire on the Mountain, and that is when the Charlie Daniels Band really exploded. Three hit singles: Orange Blossom Special, South's Gonna Do It Again, Long-Haired Country Boy. Is there a story on why you feel that album broke? Why was the timing right?
We went down to Macon, Georgia to do that album, and with a producer that I wanted to work with by the name of Paul Hornsby, who had been working with a lot of the Southern bands, with the Marshall Tucker Band, who are real friends of ours. I love the sound he was getting on them. And we went down there to record with an attitude of this. If you were to listen to all the albums that we did before that and then listen to Fire on the Mountain, you would hear more on Fire on the Mountain would be more actual, honest me with the vocals. That I had quit trying to sound like somebody else, either consciously or subconsciously, that I was going to open my mouth and sing, and whatever came out was me. It was a first really, it was down to earth honest. And we approached the music from a point of like a pristine sort of a point. Let's go in and let's play this. If there's something in it that's not exactly right, as long as it feels good, it's fine. If it feels, let's get a feel. Let's don't go for total perfection. Let's go for total feel. Let's get something that people can listen to and get into and not worry about, if there's a mistake or if there's a flaw or if there's something in it. Let's just take this band and let's play together and let's make this album as the true representation of what we are. And I think it was the honesty in it, for one thing. I think it was the selection of material. I think material was good on that album, and, of course, the performances.
All right, well, let's go back to that album. 74 was the year. Fire on the Mountain was the album, and this song was one of them all over the radio. Sal's going to do it again on Midwest Beat. More with Charlie Daniels when we come back.
Picking down in Jacksonville. People down in Georgia come from near and far to hear Richard Best picking on that red guitar. So gather round, gather round, chillin', be down. Well, just get down, chillin', get loud. Well, you can be loud, yeah, and be proud. And you can be proud, yeah, and I'll be proud too. Well, because South's gonna do it again and again. But he sure can play. And there's CZ Top, and you can't forget that old brother Will is getting soaking wet. And all the good people down in Tennessee, you're digging Barefoot Jerry and CDB. Well, gather round, chill and get down. Well, you can get down, chill and get loud. Well, you can get loud, him, be proud. Well, you can be proud, him, be proud to a rebel, cause South's gonna do it again. Yes, it is.
The South's gonna do it again. That's Charlie Daniels' band. Fire on the Mountain was the album, and this is Midwest Beat. I'm your host, Tom Lounges. My guest, the one and only Charlie Daniels. Charlie, South's gonna do it again was the first of several songs that you've given us that have truly become Southern rock anthems. It name drops so many of your contemporaries of the era, the Outlaws, Marshall Tucker, Skynyrd, Dickie Betts, Elvin Bishop, so many others. Let's talk about the whole rise of Southern rock and your part in that cultural explosion.
Well, you know, we kind of, basically, what started turning people's eyes toward the South in a big way, and it was Capricorn Records, which was the Allman Brothers to start with.
Mm-hmm. That was Phil Walden, wasn't it?
When they got out and started going, I mean, when they started getting on the radio across the country, they just blew everybody away. Dwayne Allman was a one-in-a-million guitar player. And they had the right combination of a band and the right material, the right producer, the right studio, the right everything just to make some incredible records. And when they made the Fillmore East record, I mean, the live record, just blew everybody away. And then along comes Marshall Tucker from Spartanburg, South Carolina on Capricorn, and they, I mean, they make this incredible first record. And it was, all of a sudden, there were people, there were bands from basically the same geographical area, the Southeast, that were playing on the radio that sounded different from everything else that was playing. They didn't sound like a San Francisco band or a Boston band or a whatever, an English band. They sounded like a whole different situation. So somebody came up with and dubbed it Southern music, Southern rock. And, of course, all the bands were different, but there was a thread of familiarity in all of them. They were all, you know, they all had something that kind of marked them as being Southern boys, maybe the way we pronounced our words or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the fascination with the Southern. And, of course, then along comes Skinner and the Outlaws and ZZ Top and all these people that were obviously doing it, you know, with a Southern sound to it. So somebody called it Southern rock, so there we were.
An interesting aspect of Southern rock, the overall sound, was the Guitar Army assault that everyone from the Skynyrd Boys to Molly Hatchet to the Outlaws, especially down in Tampa there. You guys, prominently, the fiddle played a big role. Now, you yourself, a session guitarist early on, your first instrument, when did you pick up fiddle, and why would you think you're the only one that actually featured the fiddle prominently?
I was actually playing fiddle way back in the early days. I learned to play fiddle not too long after I learned to play guitar. Well, I was probably about 16 or so. Okay. But when I first started playing the clubs, the popular music of the day was the rock stuff, the R&B stuff, the Little Richard, the Fats Domino, and of course Elvis Presley and Carl Perkins and Jerry Lee Lewis, and these guys that had nothing to do with the fiddle. So I played guitar. I just went totally, you know, into the guitar end of it and played, just did it that way. And for some odd reason, years after, I decided to pick up a fiddle again, and I did. And then I started, when we first started recording, I had never played that kind of fiddle. I had never played in a fiddle in, you know, real heavy-duty jamming type stuff before. I'd never done that. I'd always played square dance music and country music and bluegrass music on the fiddle. So I started playing parts, discovering parts, and creating parts that fit into the songs that we did, which gave them a different sound. I mean, everybody, you know, we still had the guitars going, the heavy guitars, the bass and drums, but on floating on top, there was this fiddle. So we were pretty easy to identify from everybody else in that. Not in every song, because I didn't use fiddle on every song, but certain the songs that I used the fiddle in, it was a little bit of a novelty. It was a little different. South's Gonna Do It was a pretty heavy, heavily weighted with fiddle. And it was not a, you know, it's not a sound you heard every day. So it was a little unique when it came out. When Fire on the Mountain came out, people kind of zeroed in on South's Gonna Do It, and it mentioned these bands, but they were hot bands at the time too. They were also bands that were playing on the radio. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a double-edged sword there. It was a little different tune that really cooked, and it talked about you know, subjects that are on everybody's mind. The Leonard Skinner Band, the Allman Brothers, you know, Marshall Tucker. And I think that's what the fascination of it actually was.
Now, Marshall Tucker, in particular, there's a little fiddle in some of their music. And as I understand it, you did the sessions for that. Is that correct?
That was me, yeah.
All right. I thought that was you.
There was a couple of different fiddle players. Early on, the very first time they did, I didn't do fiddle on that. But from there on out, Andy Stein played twin fiddles with me one time on one of their records. But I think everything on fiddle from after that first record was me.
Charlie Daniels, remembering my friend and a great musician who I had the opportunity to interview numerous times. Got to MC some shows for him, got to hang out on the tour bus once in a while with him. And one of the things about Charlie was the fact that he did so many charity events, many that were known and many that were not. As his passing came to fruition and comments were made on Facebook and memories were shared by so many people, a lot of people I know had encounters with Charlie, whether they were on road crews or opening acts, and different people had commented on things. And I knew Charlie for the work he did with St. Jude's Children's Animal Hospital. I'm sorry, St. Jude's Children's Hospital in Tennessee, and also for the work that he did with the military. Those were the two things that were, I think, most impacting about him. But he helped with in different towns as he traveled. I heard stories about him donating money and tickets to different Boy Scout groups. I know he was a big supporter of the scouting. I know that he donated to senior centers where Alzheimer's was a problem. Just so many stories. Again, these are things that have trickled down over the course of the last few days since we lost him. And some of the wonderful accolades and memories that were shared online came from many celebrities. I'll share a couple more real quick, and we'll get into the next segment. Charlie Daniels has been a friend of mine for the last 40 or 50 years. He is one of the greatest artists in country music and an all-around wonderful man. We will miss you. B.J. Thomas said that. Sam Moore of Sam and Dave said, one of the best friends, not only a peer, but a true friend. He was one of the most spiritual men I've ever known. When we got together for a show in Oklahoma, we performed Will the Circle Be Unbroken? I will never forget that night. And, of course, he worked closely with the Oak Ridge Boys, and they were involved in many of the Hall of Fames and the Grand Ole Opry with him. And Joe Bonsall, who has been on this show many times, another guy that I have had the opportunity to work with several times, said this about Charlie. All of the Oak Ridge Boys are saddened and devastated by this sudden and immeasurable loss. Charlie was not only a dear friend, but a patriot who loved Jesus and loved the USA. It is all so hard to process right now. We will miss you, Charlie, but we know where you are. The everlasting arms of his and our Savior now hold him. Until the day, Charlie, until the day, prayers for Hazel. Joe Bonsall, Oak Ridge Boys. So speaking of religious ties and beliefs, Christmas was an important time for Charlie Daniels. And when I first came here to Lakeshore in 2012, my first program was Home for the Holidays, Celebrity Memories and Interviews. And I contacted a variety of different celebrities that would share stories of their childhood holidays and current traditions and different things about the holidays that meant something to them. And I highlighted, even though it's the middle of summer and it's 90 degrees out, I thought maybe we get a little refreshing chill of the holidays, chill of snow, by sharing this. This was my commentary. It's about 2 minutes long, of Charlie about the holidays. Listen to the story he shares about his mother. It's really touches the heart.
Tom Landis, Charlie Daniels, how are you?
Hey, Charlie, good to hear your voice.
Well, it's good to talk to you.
Let's talk about the holidays and some of your childhood memories. You grew up in North Carolina. What was Christmas like in the South as a child for you?
Christmas to me is always very special. Of course, I always try to remember what the holiday is about. It's the birth of Jesus Christ, the Savior of mankind, my personal Savior. And I always try to remember that at Christmas time. And when I was a kid, it was a magical time of year. It was seemed like it never would get there to start with. And it was just a very, very special time that a kind of a euphoria settled in over the whole week. And it was just a magical time. Special music on the radio, and of course everything was decorated for Christmas, and Wilmington always had a Christmas parade, and you just get the spirit of the thing. Everybody was in good spirits, and just a very, very special time of year.
Share with me and my listeners this evening memories of a special Christmas, one that you'll never forget, and why.
I remember one Christmas that my mother was the last Christmas she was alive, and she had cancer, and she passed away that coming spring. But she always loved snow, and we were from North Carolina, and we didn't have very much snow. And after my father passed away, the last 3.5 years of her life, she came and lived on our place. She had her own place, and she lived there, and she was up at the house sometime during the Christmas season. I can't remember if it was Christmas Day or whatever, but Christmas Eve Day or something like that. But all of a sudden, it just started snowing. It was just beautiful, big white flakes of snow out across the valley in front of our house. And it only snowed for a few minutes, didn't last very long, but my mother enjoyed it so much. I always said that God sent that snow for my mother. I just thought it was a really nice thing to have happen the last Christmas of her life. That was in Tennessee after we had moved up there.
I thought that was one of the finest stories shared in the series that I had done called Home for the Holidays with the celebrities. Many, many celebrities talked to me about that, including the Oak Ridge Boys and the Nelson Brothers and just everybody. But that was one of the most touching. You could tell he was very touched and choked up when he spoke of that last Christmas with his mother and how God had sent snow her way, which was her final wish. Another thing that we talked about, I didn't include that in that clip, was how one of his favorite toys as a young child growing up in the South was finding a toy drum under the Christmas tree, and it was his first musical instrument. And I asked him about that. Here's that clip.
Well, Charlie, I remember last time we talked on my Home for the Holidays show, you talked about finding a toy drum under the Christmas tree as a very young boy, and that you felt that kind of triggered your love of music. Is that about right?
Well, you know what? I don't remember when my love of music first started, but I certainly remember that drum, and I remember beating the head out of it, you know, trying to play it. But I think I was born with a love for music, Tom. It's just, I'm sure that helped incite it, but I can't remember a time when I didn't just absolutely adore music.
At what age did you start playing then? At some point you had to pick up that first guitar.
I got a little bit of a late start. I was about 15 when I first started playing, and a friend of mine that I had known for some time, but I had no idea that he had an old guitar and knew about two chords on it, and I went up to his house one day, and he had took the darn thing out and was messing with it, and so we started, I got him to teach me what he knew, and we just started from there. So it's about late stages of 14 or early 15 when I got started.
Do you remember the point when you thought this might be a great way to make a living?
Yeah, I started thinking that long before I had the wherewithal to do it. by the time I had learned to play a couple of songs, that's all I ever wanted to do. I never wanted to do anything else, but at the time that I came along, there's really no place to play. I'm speaking of the 50s back in North Carolina. And it was before, you know, the open bars, the clubs and things opened up where a musician could work. So we were kind of limited as to what we could do. But I kept trying and trying and finally got a job 6 nights a week playing in Jacksonville, North Carolina, which is up next to the Camp Lejeune 2nd Marine Division base. And I got to play up there 6 nights a week and kind of, you learn a lot when you do that. That's a great way to start, is because you're playing a lot of different kinds of music and you're kind of under the gun for 5 hours a night, you know, and you got to keep your chops up. You got to keep learning new tunes and that sort of thing, and learn to meet the competition. And that's a lot of what the music business is about.
Well, a lot of folks that grew up with your music in the 70s during the heydays may not realize that you were there at the birth of rock and roll, right along with the Carl Perkins and the Elvises and the Jerry Lees. And as you mentioned, you started playing in the 50s. Was that mostly just the local circuit, though, or did you do any recording back then?
It was the local. I never got into recording until about 1959, in that era that I got seriously into it. I took my first trip to California. We were playing up in the Washington, D.C. area, and I took my first trip to California and went through Fort Worth, Texas to see a friend of mine and met a guy by the name of Bob Johnston, who at the time was working at Bell Helicopter in the daytime and doing whatever he could in the music business at night, in their production, writing, that sort of thing. And he wanted to make a record with us, so we went to the studio in Fort Worth and made our first real record, which is called Jaguar. It was an instrumental record, and Bob went on from there to, he went to New York. He started recording Simon and Garfunkel and Bob Dylan and Marty Robbins and Johnny Cash and just a whole bunch of people. He moved to Nashville in 1967, and I moved to Nashville in 67 too. And he's been a lot of help to me. If there's anybody I owe something to in the music business, it's Bob Johnston. But it's been a long, wonderful, enjoyable trip. And you know, every time your priorities change, your goals change. If you accomplish one thing, you look a little higher, you go for something else, and that's how it goes. I'm still to this day, you know, I've got goals and things that I want to do, and songs that I want to record and styles that I want to play in and that sort of thing. So you never run out of something exciting in this business.
One thing Charlie always told me during every interview is how many projects he had on the back burner. whether it was a recording at his church, whether it was recording with a side group he was looking to form, which we will get to momentarily during this show. He always had so many irons in the fire and so many goals. At 83 years old, we lost him on Monday, July 6th, at Summit Medical Center in Hermitage, Tennessee. Charlie passed away, caused a death, hemorrhagic stroke. But he lived the life, I'll tell you, and he lived for his flag, his country, and to serve those who served our country. One of the things that is unmistakable about Charlie, whether you want to talk about the many accolades and awards, the Dove Awards, the Grand Ole Opry, the Hall of Fames, one of the things that he was most proud of is the work he did with the military and helping those that were the American warriors. I talked to Charlie many times, actually, about his work with the military. And this is a clip that includes his thoughts of what was going through his mind during 9/11 and also a little bit about, you'll hear it. This is Charlie on the military and his love of it.
Let's talk a little about the many tours and the many military bases and your bond with our American warriors. You have been overseas. You have played the domestic bases. What is this special bond that has developed, and are there any special moments for you during the military visits that stand out the most?
Well, let me tell you where my patriotism was born. I'm from Wilmington, North Carolina, which is a seaport town, and back during the Second World War, I remember the day Pearl Harbor was bombed. I remember when the war started, and I remember Wilmington being a seaport town. We had shipping out of their ships that came out of their oil tankers of ships that carried goods over to the war effort in Europe that were sunk by German U-boats just off of our coast, sometimes so close it was said that you could see the burning of the battle fires from our beaches. And the war was very real to us. It was in the day before satellites and TV and that sort of thing. And we never knew but what the Germans might try to bring the war on shore. So we had air raid drills. We had blackouts. We were very, very serious about the war. This was my formative years. I was 5 years old when Pearl Harbor was bombed. And the war, as I said, was very real to us. And I learned very early in my life that two things protect America is the grace of God and the United States military. That is true. Was true then. It's true now. It will be true as long as America stays a free and sovereign nation. And I just came up with this feeling of being beholden, of being in debt to people who put those uniforms on and go put their lives between us and our enemies. And it's very obvious that over the years, it's not always been this way, I don't think. I think it's always used to at least be better, that we tended to take better care of our veterans than we do now. And there seems to be a lackadaisical attitude in the government. I'm sure not with everybody there, but enough so that our veterans are suffering from lack of care, lack of counseling, lack of a lot of things. Suicide rate is extremely high. And in the state of Tennessee, our General Max Haston, who is our adjutant general for the state of Tennessee, has worked with some suicide prevention people. There is an app that is given free to people in the military, our veterans, and they get that app on their phone, they are immediately connected with a professional, a healthcare professional that specializes in talking people down from committing suicide. These kinds of things fly below the radar, and they're things that need to be addressed. There are a lot of our veterans that are hurt. They need, for one thing, just somebody say, hey, we're here for you. We're here to try to help you get what you need. We literally do care about you. I know when you go to VA, you sit in a room and you fill out a lot of papers and people come in and treat you coldly and all. That's not what this is about. We owe you. You have gone and put your life on the line for us. You've lost a limb. You can't pursue the dream you intended to pursue when you went in, that you knew when you were going to get out as a young man, young woman, you were going to do something else, but you've been disabled from doing that. So let's get you a new dream. Let's go to college. Let's learn something. Let's help you get a new life going here. That's what Journey Home is all about, is to try to fill in the gaps that are being missed by our government and everybody else, to try to to make up slack in the lives of our heroes. They really are heroes. Anybody who goes and puts their life on the line for us is actually a hero in my book.
Well, you released a wonderful album called The Land That I Love a few years ago, a compilation of some of your patriotic songs. And I'd like to play the track The Last Fallen Hero, which is a moving song. Is there a special story behind that?
Well, there's a special story in that I was just so dumbfounded when the trade towers went down. As I said, I was born in 1936. I've gone through all the Second World War, the Korean War, Vietnam War, and all the scrambles and things we've had between. And nothing like that had ever happened in all my lifetime. And I always felt that America was safe. I always felt that America was strong and that our infrastructure and our intelligence and that sort of thing was strong enough that we would not allow anything like that to happen. And it happened, and it was not just that it happened, but it happened at such a magnitude that two symbols of our America, of our country, had been taken down in a single day by a handful of fanatics. And it was just devastating to me. I mean, it was devastating to the country. I remember that day. I remember how confusing it was. We didn't know what was happening. We didn't know who was doing it. We didn't know where it was going to stop or how far it was going to go. And, of course, information was sketchy at the time. It just came out in drips and drabs. And everybody was, you know, very anxious. And it impressed me and impressed in my mind, and I wanted to write something about it, and that's the result. That's all I need.
Oh, the cowards came by morning and attacked without a warning, leaving flames and death and chaos in our streets. And in the middle of this fiery hell, brave heroes fell. In the skies of Pennsylvania, on a plane bound for destruction, with the devil and his angels at the wheel. They never reached their target on the ground. Brave heroes brought it down. This is a righteous cause, so without doubt or pause, I will do what my country has to me. Make me any sacrifice, we'll pay whatever price, so the children of tomorrow can be free. Lead on, red, white, and blue, and we will follow you until we win the final victory. God help us do our best. We will not slack or rest till the last fallen hero rests in peace. Now the winds of war are blowing, there's no way of knowing where this bloody path we're traveling will lead. We must follow till the end or face it all again. And make no mistake about it, write it, preach it, talk it, shout it, across the mountains and the deserts and the seas. The blood of innocence and shame will not be shed in vain. This is a righteous cause, so without doubt or pause, I will do what my country asks of me. Make any sacrifice, we'll pay whatever price, so the children of on red, white, and blue, and we will follow.
rest in peace.
The Last Fallen Hero. Written by Charlie Daniels, performed by the CDB, Charlie Daniels Band, the CDB out of Tennessee, and that is his tribute to the Patriots of 9/11. And what an interesting man he was.